Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's September 22nd, 2017 program. Our two-party political system, yesterday and today, with Tony Corcoran and Jack Roberts. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy, or so we hope. Support of City Club is provided by members and sponsors, including Hearing Associates, AARP of Oregon, Dot Dotson's Photography, and a special thanks to the University of Oregon Academic Extension and KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Mondays following the program. I want to thank the coordinator of today's program, John Belcher. Thank you. And John is going to do the introductions of our speakers today.
Thank you, Sandra. Today we welcome two self-described old political has-beens, Jack Roberts and Tony Corcoran, to reflect on how our political system worked in the past and what it will take to get it working again, both on the national and local level. In case you aren't already familiar with the public service of these two fellows, let me give you a brief recap. Jack Roberts, a Republican, served as a Lane County Commissioner from 1989 to 1995. In 1994, he was elected the State Labor Commissioner. That position leads the Bureau of Labor and Industry. You might know it better by its acronym, BOLI. He served in that position from 95 to 2003. While there, he successfully worked to make it a nonpartisan office. Jack then became the director of Lane County Metro Partnership, a nonprofit economic development agency, and next he served as director of the Oregon State Lottery from 2013 to 2016. And Jack previously wrote a biweekly column for the Oregonian from 2009 to 2013. Tony Corcoran, a Democrat, worked for 15 years for the Oregon Public Employees Union and their local SEIU 503. He then represented Cottage Grove and the surrounding areas of the Oregon in the Oregon House of Representatives from 1994 to 1998, when he was elected to the Oregon State Senate, where he served through 2003's legislative session. In 2003, he was appointed to a full-time position on the Oregon Employment Appeals Board. Tony also writes, he writes a column for Eugene Weekly, analyzing state politics and the state legislature. I am so pleased to have these two gentlemen speak to our City Club today. They indeed have demonstrated that they are gentlemen in their demeanor, whether working within their public or political organization or across the aisle with the other political party to craft bipartisan legislation. That is not to say they don't hold strong opinions on how Oregon should be governed. This was most recently evidenced a few weeks ago when Jack wrote an op-ed for the Register Guard supporting the gubernatorial candidacy of Newt Bueller, which was quickly followed by an opposing letter to the editor from Tony. Nevertheless, they still remain congenial as evidenced by their presence here today. Let's learn from their experience and wisdom about how we can increase civility and cooperation in Oregon's political process. Who knows, maybe we can set the example for the rest of the country. So by coin flip, we will start with Jack. But as he comes up to speak, let's give them both a round of applause to welcome them.
It was kind of interesting in talking to John about what we wanted to talk about and how we would pair off. Tony and I have known each other for a long time, and we've always been friendly, but we've always been very competitive. And we'll see if any of that comes through today. But the main thing I want to talk about, it's easy to get caught up in your own career and what you've done, but I have to confess that I was a political junkie long before I got in politics. The first election that I followed in the campaign was 1964 when Barry Goldwater ran for president. I was in a Republican family. I was the only one in my family who was for Goldwater before the convention. My parents thought he was a little extreme, but as a 12-year-old, I thought he was just great. I was devastated when he lost. But partly as a result of that, I was hooked on politics. And 2 years later, there was no presidential election, but we had what I still remember as a great state of Oregon matchup in three important races. First of all, our governor, Mark Hatfield, was getting the end of his second term, so he couldn't run again for governor. But the Senate seat, which was held by Maureen Neuberger, the widow of Richard Neuberger, Democrat, was not running again. So that seat was vacant. Mark Hatfield decided he wanted to run for the Senate. And our 4th District Congressman at the time, Robert Duncan, thought he also would like to run for the Senate. And that put together a great matchup of two outstanding candidates running for the U.S. Senate. Meanwhile, the governorship being vacant at the end of that election period drew two outstanding candidates as well. Secretary of State Tom McCall, who was Republican, and the state treasurer, perhaps, I think you might say, the best state treasurer we've ever had in terms of what he did in consolidating the financing of the state and the work that he did, for which he gets almost no credit today, but that was Bob Straub. And Bob, of course, had been a Lane County commissioner, and I always have certain fondness for Lane County commissioners, and also served in the legislature from this area. But you had a state treasurer and secretary of state, and they were going to run against each other for governor. Meanwhile, the 4th District, which was left vacant, was going to be fought out between a Medford state representative. And in those days, you have to remember, we only had 4 congressional districts. So the 4th District then still included Jackson, Josephine County. And there were those days, you often had conservative Democrats from the southern part of the state. And Bob Duncan was, by today's measure, a fairly conservative Democrat. He had twice been Speaker of the House and the legislature. Now he wanted, and he ran for Congress and was successful there. Now he wanted to step up to the Senate. So that left a vacancy, which the battle was between John Dellenbach, a state representative from Medford, and a Eugenian who had already been a 2-term congressman in that same district, Charlie Porter. So if you look at that lineup, it had 6 people running for office. 4 of them, at some time in their career, were in Congress. 2 of them were governors. And that was the lineup we had. And it wasn't, as you see today, all the conservatives were on the Republican side and the liberals on the Democrat side. By today's standards, you'd say that Mark Hatfield and Tom McCall were probably liberal. In fact, it would be shocking to find people who held their positions running as a Republican today in a statewide race. On the other hand, Bob Duncan was fairly conservative. In fact, the issue that really divided Hatfield and Duncan in that race was the Vietnam War, because Hatfield was against the war and Duncan supported the war. He was a loyal Democrat. It was the Johnson administration. He was for the war. Now, I remember this whole election fondly because the Republicans won all 3 of those races. But beyond that, looking back on the people and how they stood, it would be hard to look at that from today's perspective and say those were traditional Democrat-Republican races. Move forward 50 years. The election last year. Had a U.S. Senate race up, governor's race up, and a 4th District race up. Instead of being 4 vacancies, those were all held by incumbents. And all the incumbents were Democrats. Kate Brown was just recently an incumbent because of Kitzhaber's resignation. It's also a seat that not normally would have been up that time, but it was up and it was running. Meanwhile, you had one of the longest-serving politicians in Oregon, Ron Wyden, who had been in the congressional seat in the 3rd District and U.S. Senate. He was running for re-election. And Peter DeFazio here, who is the longest-serving congressman in Oregon history, they were all running for re-election. So who did the Republicans put up against them? Well, for governor, we had Bud Pierce, who had never run for any office before in his life. Mark Callahan, who has run for every office in the world and never won anything. And then Art Robinson, who has consistently run for the 4th District congressional seat and lost. Comparing that matchup to what we had 50 years earlier, caused me to wonder what happened. As a lifelong Republican, what have we done wrong? Now, the demographic changes, the other things that have happened, but the two things that I think have really changed in politics over that time that I've seen that has the biggest concern to me, one is a growing polarization of the parties. We used to have conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. They were in the minority in each of their parties, but they gave voice to that. They gave balance. It also helped to temper a lot of the debate because it's hard to attack somebody for its terrible, outlandish, irresponsible view if your other member of your parties also hold that same view. It really forced us, I think, to concentrate more on the issues themselves and not on the personalities and not on the character of the people that were running. But the other thing that I think that changed is that it used to be those seats that you saw, you worked your way up to them. You didn't suddenly wake up one morning and say, I could do that. I mean, I mentioned Mark Callahan. In addition to running for office here, last election, he put his name in the New Hampshire and Arizona primaries for president. I mean, I guess he doesn't lose any bigger there than he does in any other race that he runs, but... And he's now running for the 5th district, so he doesn't seem to be learning from that experience. But I have to wonder, why can't we get people in my party who understand that you work your way up to these offices, and you learn along the way, not only how to do your job, but how to communicate and express what you believe and what you think to the voters that you want to serve. And that's been, for me, the biggest area of concern I have. I do think Democrats have done a better job of it. I remember back in 1972 when we had the Nixon landslide over McGovern, and Oregon was one of the states that went big for Nixon as well as the others. There were two areas that I remember in the 4th District that went for McGovern despite that. It was Springfield and Coos Bay. Now you look at those communities today, you wouldn't guess that they'd be going. They don't vote Democrat in presidential elections. But in those days, you had blue-collar workers for Weyerhaeuser and wood products, and you had wood products and shipping over the coast. Those were strong private sector union areas. I mean, some people have to be reminded that we used to have private sector unions. In fact, in those days, you couldn't have public employees. That really didn't, the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act didn't pass until 1973. But the strong union voters were turning out and voting Democrat. They've changed. But I think they're still looking for a voice. That's part of what the whole thing about Trump that caught a lot of us, and I'll include myself in that by surprise, was the fact that a lot of the blue-collar working people were looking for an answer. I don't think they found their answer, but I do think that unless we as political parties, both parties, start concentrating and looking at trying to provide that rather than seeing this just as a competition between the two of us for the next position or the next post, I'm afraid that the decay that I'm seeing in the two-party system will continue, and I think that would be really unfortunate. So, Tony, I'll turn it over to you.
My name is Tony Corcoran. 23 years ago in 1994, Jack Roberts beat four-time incumbent Mary Wendy Roberts, no relation. Wikipedia even says that, no relation, Jack. It's amazing. To become labor commissioner, and I won my first electoral race for the Oregon House. Needless to say, our political careers took much different routes. I call my path from Newt to Newt, from Gingrich to Buehler. Has anything really changed? As I walk through these past 20 years plus while preparing these comments, I can point to things that have changed and things that have remained the same. Measure 25 passed in 1996. It required a 3/5 majority for state tax measures. That was a huge change. The U.S. Supreme Court's Citizen United case on corporate campaign finance, huge change. The way state lobby money flows through caucus leaders rather than through candidates, huge change. And the loss of legislative camaraderie, also a huge change. Nationally, exacerbated partisanship beginning midterm of Bill Clinton's first term, 1994, lasting through W and culminating in the birther dog whistle Obama billary backlash that got us Kim Jong Trump. Huge change. The one problem that's never changed in those 23 years is the state's over-reliance on personal income tax to fund schools, universities, public safety, and human services. When I called Jack to talk about this event, he pointed out that given our age, he probably would be more interested in hearing the historical perspective. I'm 68, he's about to turn 65, so you probably don't want our perspective on future public policy. From a personal perspective, I've always viewed Jack as a reasonable, moderate Republican in the Dave Frohnmeyer mold, and I believe they are endangered species these days. These days, if you're a Republican in the legislature and you support revenue for schools or public safety or human services, you're going to get Tea Partied. You're going to have a know-nothing primary opponent. The saddest example of this was in 2004 when a retired high school baseball coach and an Oregon legend from Salem, Vic Backlund, was Tea Partied and lost to Kim Thatcher, a true know-nothing anti-tax activist, all because of a tax vote. And by the way, Jack, Newt Bueller is an opportunist, not a moderate. He played the obstructionist all the way with House Republican Leader Mike McClain and Senate Leader Ted Farioli this last session. He was absolutely absent last session. In the plus 20 years, in the past 20 years, I served 10 years in the legislature and 12 years on the state's Employment Appeals Board. I retired in 2015 after reading and voting on 30,000 disputed administrative decisions regarding unemployment insurance benefit in a monastery. That was a very interesting perch from which to observe the 2008 Wall Street crash and the victims. Whether it was the displaced Hewlett-Packard workers, the Wells Fargo workers, or small businesses too overwhelmed to even show up at the hearings. I also spent the last 11 years as a volunteer on the Citizens Review Board, which is part of the Oregon Judicial Department that reviews cases of children in Lane County who've been removed from the home. I've watched the up and down funding of Child Protective Services workers and its effect on their workload in the lives of those kids. That's another interesting perch. And just for full disclosure, my Tier 1 PERS monthly benefit is equivalent to my monthly Social Security check. I am not part of the Coach Bilotti problem. I wish. Ask Uncle Phil's attorney why they insisted that shoe endorsement money should be treated as university salary, and you might get the $40,000 answer to one tiny little bit of the unfunded actuarial liability of PERS. Talk about unintended consequences. Anyway, back to 94. My timing for getting in politics was impeccable. I got elected during the Gingrich Revolution, which resulted in Republicans gaining 54 seats in the U.S. House and 8 in the U.S. Senate. Here in Oregon, for the first time, Republicans took control of both chambers, first time in 40 years. Thank God for John Kitzhaber. Given the feeding frenzy Republicans went on for the next 8 years, there's no wonder they called him Dr. No for all his vetoes. Some things stayed the same throughout my legislative life. Attacking public employees was as much in vogue in my first session in 95 as it was in my last session in 2003. In fact, 95 was the year that we created PERS Tier 2. And not surprisingly, although many of the politicians have changed, the issue then was identical to the issue this year. Republicans and corporations demanded changes to PERS from the Democrats and unions in exchange for adequate taxes for school funding and public services. But at least in 95, we talked to each other, and the Republican caucus was not mostly inhabited by hardline right-wingers. Sure, there was the Eileen Q. Tubbs and the Charles Starrs. Charles Starr was actually a member of the Oregon Natural Party, Law Party, with its genetic engineering ideas. He was fun to talk to. And I didn't have much use for Bob Tiernan. Remember him? He was the guy that alleged that my union members, the service employees, had made threatening calls to his home phone. The state police even gave him a Kevlar vest and an escort. I watched him one day gallivanting around with his escort. I asked one of the cops, "Why are you protecting this man? After all, Tiernan was trying to steal your public employee retirement." One of the state police lieutenants that was following the entourage whispered to me, "The guns aren't loaded." But in 1995, there were some genuine, moderate, smart Republicans like Ray Baum, Bev Clarno, Lynn Lundquist, Bob Repine, Lane Shetterly. Even in the majority, they treated us with respect, and more importantly, they were able to negotiate a deal with John Kitzhaber without having to accede to the most conservative caucus members. That was Kate's dilemma this last session. There was no moderate Republican leadership. And I'm not saying that about Mike McClain. I'm just saying that about their caucus. In 1997, I had the pleasure of meeting Republican Ben Westland, a freshman House member. He had made his money on kitty litter, and he owned a minor league baseball team in Bend. He was delightful, funny, instant big man on campus in ways and means, hard worker, and a teetotaler. But he spent hours with us at the other watering hole in Salem, Magoo's, drinking water and chewing Nicorette gum. Because he was a ways and means guy, he was never on the floor at the end of the session except to come in and quickly vote. On one forestry bill that the Republicans loved and Kitzhaber hated, I switched the voting buttons on his desk. Usually green was an I and red was an O. As Ben walked out the door right after his vote, I asked him why he voted no. He was reasonably perplexed until he figured out what I had done. He then changed his vote. Ramona Kennedy, the chief clerk of the House, read me the riot act. Ben loved it. I never served in the majority, by the way, in any of my five sessions. I always served as the minority whip, both in the House and the Senate, except for the last session in 2003, when the Senate was tied at 15-15. My title was Democratic whip that year. My job was to count votes, which meant talking to Republicans as well as Democrats. By the time I got to the Senate in 99, we even had a bipartisan Senate drinking club at the Ram Brewery. We called ourselves the Buttface Caucus. That was named after the pub's amber beer and not Randy Miller's ugly mug. Democrats Ryan Deckert and Rick Metzger and Republicans Randy Miller and Tom Hartung and I would meet every couple of weeks. The first person who mentioned legislative business had to buy a round. We talked about family and travel and made fun of every lobbyist we knew. Randy Miller even offered once to take any golfing senator, regardless of party, to play 18 holes at the soon-to-be-opening Bandon Dunes. We had a blast. 2003 was my last session. That's when we did the last PERS reforms, with the Senate tied at 15-15. I was co-chair of the PERS committee with Republican John Menis, a Portland police officer. Ironically, even though John was a public employee, he was unaffected personally regarding PERS, because the Portland police and firefighters have their own separate retirement and disability plan. Anyway, I worked closely with Governor Kulongowski's staff to make five major reforms, and Teddy had his own views. Having served on the Oregon Supreme Court, he thought he could pass their review of the reforms. He ended up being 80% right. Supreme Court ultimately threw out his weakest proposal and the one with dire future consequences, eliminating the 8% assumption on earnings. As a result of the 2003 reforms, I lost my job as a legislator, sued and settled with my union, and Governor Kulongowski appointed me to the appeals board as a labor member. The vote required Senate confirmation, which I got by a 28-1 vote. Guess who voted against me? Anybody take a guess? Gary George, father of Larry George, who ran Oregonians in Action, right-wing property rights group. After 2003, I observed the legislature as any citizen would. Since I worked in Salem, I would often visit with my two successors, Senator Floyd Prezansky and Paul Holvey, in the House when they were there during their now yearly sessions. And I loved talking revenue issues with Phil Barnhart, Lee Byer. And then to top it off, Floyd and my longtime friend Paul Kaplan formed the Hot Air Society. So legislators, their spouses, employers, and other roustabouts drink beer, discuss gardening, and complain about life in general, most Thursday nights at Cornucopia. I only made one visit to Salem during this session. I'd had both knees replaced over the last year, so that slowed me down a bit. But Salem was a morgue this time. I talked to lobbyists and legislators from both sides of the aisle, and they pretty much all agreed on one thing. Kim Jong-Trump's election had a definite impact on Republican resistance and obstruction last session in Salem. Republicans were emboldened by Trump's electoral victory, and Newt Bueller was knee-deep in that obstruction. So to address what went wrong and what it would take to get the political system working better again, both on the national and local level, I don't have any answers. Who could have anticipated two significant economic downturns that nailed Oregon in the early 90s and the 2008 Wall Street crash? Who could have anticipated the string of Oregon Supreme Court decisions, all based on the fact that a deal's a deal on PERS? The last one alone, in 2015, increased the unfunded actuarial liability by $4 billion in one swoop. Who could have anticipated the U.S. Supreme Court uncorking the corporate genie and unleashing unheard amounts of money from the Koch brothers and the Mercers of the world? Look at Robert Mercer's spending against Peter DeFazio. It was obscene. And how do you put Grover Norquist and Steve Bannon back in the bottle? For that matter, how do you convince Greg Walden to protect Medicaid in Oregon? Medicaid pays for half the births in Oregon. That means half the deliveries in Oregon are to a parent who earns less than $16,000 or $32,900 for a family of four. Imagine raising two kids on $32,000 a year. The state tax system must be repaired. Our over-reliance on personal income tax will devastate us when the next market bubble hits. And we have to elect people who will problem solve and not obstruct. Republicans now control most legislatures and most governorships these days, but it's been done by undermining government and public institutions. But government is public education, it is public safety, is human services, and these services are paid with taxes. Anyway, any of you who know me has heard this rant before. I attended Peter's packed town hall at LCC early in the year. There are plenty of people with plenty of energy to fight the fight. All I can say is, never give up, bring back facts, as the Blackberry Pie Society says, and drink local craft beer. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both our speakers, Jack Roberts and Tony Corcoran. So now we'll take a break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table and then return with audience questions. Remember, only City Club members or reciprocal members from Springfield are allowed to ask questions at the microphone. Thank you.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the September 22nd City Club program, our two-party political system, yesterday and today, with Jack Roberts and Tony Corcoran. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Hearing Associates, AARP of Oregon, Dot Dotson's Photography, and special thanks to the University of Oregon Academic Extension and KLCC Radio.
I'm Ruth Daimler. I want to tell you how much I enjoyed today's program. It was just great to have you both. I've always admired both of you. My question is, when do you think we're going to have single payer? I see the need for it every day. I see people pushed out of their homes and on the street because they can't pay for it. What's going to happen? And what do you think is the best way to get it?
I don't know. If you read the paper yesterday, I mean, Oregon's going to get trashed on the latest Senate Republican proposal, which would then go back to the House if it, God forbids, it passes. So I don't think you'll see single payer before Christmas. Don't count on that. I think the interesting thing about single payer, the only thing I'll say about that, is that the movement for single payer has actually been stimulated by McConnell and Ryan's behavior on this issue. And so, to the extent that I think single payer probably has a better chance now than it's had in the past 20 years, just because of the disruption. Just think if they destroyed the health insurance market. You'd have to go to single payer pretty quickly. So, anyway.
Well, one of the problems I think we have in healthcare is that the tendency to try to oversimplify what is really a complex problem. That we say, well, single payer or Medicare for all, there are a lot of different variations that get you to 100% coverage around the world. In fact, very few of them have a traditional single payer system. What I think is clearly true is that our system of trying to primarily pay for insurance through your employment is becoming unworkable in an environment where even people who are making a good income often don't have a single employer and don't have the opportunity. So we are going to see a major change. What we really need to do is to get back to the days when we could have a bipartisan discussion about these things. That broke down initially over Obamacare because, frankly, the Republicans were in such a minority that they said, we're better off just sitting back and not trying to get involved in this, which was a big mistake in my view and hurt us from a policy standpoint. And now, because it's all about repeal and replace with no idea what to replace it with, that we're also having a problem trying to deal with it. But the notion that you could impose a single-payer system with the cost structure of medical services as we have in the United States today, I think is not realistic. And it's going to take a long time, and it's going to take a number of iterations to get through that. But I would hope that, it sounds today like the latest Republican plan is not going to pass, which means that you can't get through on just a straight party line vote. Then I hope at some point, having exhausted all other alternatives, they'll work together and we'll find something. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be quick. And I don't think it's going to be easy, just given the system that we've allowed to build up and how we provide medical services today is not going to be easily reduced to a Medicare for all or single payer system.
Hi, my name is Roz Stein, and for the fourth time now, the Oregon legislature has not passed the national vote, popular vote, interstate compact. I would like to hear your opinions about it and why you think it's not going through. It was just by a hair this last time.
Yeah, this is Jack Roberts. I don't know why they're not passing it, but I hope they continue not to pass it. I don't support that. We have an electoral college for a reason, which is to try to elect people on a balanced basis across the country and not allow large states to compile huge majorities that can affect that result. I think a lot of people maybe don't realize that the entire electoral vote system is designed to make sure that small states do have some bigger voice in the decisions we make. But clearly, in the case as just happened, the entire popular vote margin that Hillary Clinton got was accounted for by California. And if you then add in New York to that, basically that's like a 6 or 7 percentage swing. And I don't think that it does make sense. If we were going to have a popular vote, that we should have a debate about that, not on a state-by-state basis, but amend the Constitution. And I don't favor having a decision made by popular vote.
One of the nice things about getting old and the reason you're
this
so blissed
Tony
out when you're
Corcoran.
Old. Oh, Tony Corcoran, I'm sorry. Maybe what I'm going to say, I'll say I'm Jack Roberts. Anyway, there's a lot bigger fish to fry at 68 than trying to do a constitutional amendment on this. 70% of the population of the U.S. is in 7 states, and you're going to have, that's part of the explanation for these disparities. I believe like everybody else did that Hillary Clinton, won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College, and I believe that Donald Trump was smart about that, but I believe there's other things you have to factor in. 20% in those 3 states that made the difference, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Democrats stayed home, number one, and the Bernie Sanders supporters, 20% of them voted for Trump. I mean, figure that out, factor that into it. So they were really polarized candidates. I really think there was a 24-year anti-Bubba, Clinton rap that the Republicans got away with really well. And Hillary, unfortunately, she was doubled up on, basically, and also by Putin. But, I don't think it's worth, I think it's more important to look at income disparity in the United States and start dealing with that as an issue, because that's not a constitutional issue. That's an issue of government and disruption.
I'm Jack Dresser. My question about the two-party system is how to move beyond it. Only 21%, 29% respectively of the registered voters identify with Republicans 21, Democrats 29. So half the population registers as neither of the above. And I think the population is really understanding something that two political scientists from Northwestern and Princeton published last year. They did a study, 20-year study of federal policy decisions, over 1,700 federal policy decisions, and they found that popular opinion, right, and through surveys and public opinion through organized political groups, accounted for zero correlation with federal policy.
And the question is?
Pardon?
And the question is?
Well, I asked the question at the beginning, how to move beyond this.
Say it again.
The government does not represent the people, and so how do we move beyond the two-party system?
Great, got it.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I started with the question.
You did.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
This is Tony Corcoran. I see the demographic changes from the time I got involved in politics, when I was a union rep. And the unions themselves have had a lot of talk about this, because if you create a people's workers' party, How does that affect the rank-and-file Democrats in Portland versus Coos Bay, like Jack was pointing out, the difference in demographics, those kind of places? You know, I'm a union guy. My whole thing's about organizing, and so I think it's unfortunate that we inherited the political system we did, but it's what we got now. It's sort of like when Robert Kennedy wanted Hoover fired, and when he went into Lyndon Johnson, Lyndon Johnson said, I'm not firing him. I'd rather have him on the inside of the tent pissing out. And so I kind of feel that way about Democrats. And the thing that's most concerning to me is the single issue nature of the two parties, that within those two parties, if you're not pro-choice, you're not a Democrat. If you're not pro-life, you're not a Republican, for instance, you know, and those kind of, the single issue stuff is the most important thing that has to be focused on.
This is Jack Roberts. I have to say I probably agree with Tony in the sense that I actually think the two-party system is a strength of our system, and that the fact that it's not working too well right now is because the parties themselves have become too rigid and dogmatic, which is what you normally see in a multi-party system. And you have to form your coalitions after the people have cast their votes and folks get together in a room and decide what coalition we put together to try to govern. I think what it really needs is to go back to the older system where within both political parties there were liberal conservative wings, there were urban and rural wings. You had all of this and you brought it together because that's what you had to do to compete in order to be successful. I think that there is a room for a challenge from third parties, and we've seen them in the past, and they can have some influence for a while. But long term, I think that our system, if you compare it to other parliamentary democracies around the rest of the world, the British system as it's devolved into from we used to be a two-party system, and looking at what's happening in other places in Europe and around the world, I think our system is still a better system. I don't think it's serving us very well, but ultimately we have control as voters, and we need to express that and let them know that we're not happy.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. What will Republicans or Democrats do for the large number of people who fell out of America's economy, who can't donate and aren't even mentioned by name, homeless people?
This is Jack Roberts. I don't think that either party does a very good job of addressing issues like that where people have largely checked out of the economy or checked out of the community or checked out of society. And I think it's hard to deal with on a national level. I do know the efforts that are made here locally. Having been a county commissioner, knowing the counties often take a role in that, it's hard enough just to get basic services to people, finding ways to channel them back into the economy at a time when our economy itself is changing so rapidly that the biggest challenge facing us, I think, as a society in the future is how do we keep people employed and working and contributing in a society where people are becoming more and more expendable. And so in the broader sense, I think that the only way to really get that done politically is to exert political pressure, which means that folks who are not homeless and who are engaged in society and engaged in the community have to be heard that that's important to us and that we expect that. And that's hard to do at a time when you have so many other things that are affecting you. A lot of folks will say, I do really care about that, but I especially care about my family and the support that we need and the job that I have. It's not easy. But this is not one of those things we can pass off as, well, the system is failing us. We're failing if we're letting that get forgotten or slips between the cracks.
Well, Jerry knows the answer to this. Tony Corcoran. Jerry knows the answer to this better than anybody here. He's a longtime volunteer for the homeless. And I got involved in a little bit of the homeless stuff after I retired, and I was more interested in pounding nails for Habitat. But I found this one program. The guy that has the camera for this show today is running, and it's called Square One, and it's taking one segment of the homeless, and what was so appealing to me about this program is that they're giving these people a grub stake. They're actually going to have the equivalent of some money to get into an actual place with these small homes. They're not transitional homes. These people actually have equity in the home, and it follows them through. So my biggest concern is people who are, through no fault of their own, homeless and really trying to make a transition back somewhere. And the biggest obstacle for women, if they have a child, is childcare. I mean, you put that on top of first month's rent, last month's rent, security, all that stuff. People can't afford it. So what Dan Bryant and Square One and those volunteers are doing is really one good way to just say, all right, you know, I can't do it for everybody, but here's 22 homes we're putting up, you know, on, what is it, First and Van Buren. So that's one step.
Susan Connolly, City Club member. Thank you both so much for coming. Our table talked about how to engage young people, and we talked about how they are not engaged in this, in the opera, they're not engaged in the symphony, they're not doing much on the bowling team, they're not here at City Club. So how do you engage these young people in politics?
The only example I can give is our son is 35. He lives up in Talkeetna, Alaska, and never a real actor. He's up in Alaska because there's too many people in Oregon. And, you know, he's 35 now, and all of a sudden, in the last two or three years, he started writing letters to the editor. And some guy in Anchorage engaged him and wrote back and said he was full of baloney. And Simon wrote back that he wasn't, you know? And, I mean, some of it, I had, you know, Jack had the same thing, I'm sure, in his offices, is, you know, the interns, the young people, you know, I still see them in terms of, you know, kids that were in the legislative process as interns or as residents or as volunteers. So I think a lot of the reason that young kids aren't involved in politics, and I really mean this sincerely, is that we've gone through a whole generation now, you know, 25, 30 years of anti-government sentiment, and it's been very successful. I tried to look up the percentages of legislatures controlled by Democrats versus Republicans when I got into office and what they are now. I just know that they're very skewed towards Republicans and have been for a long time, and there's a lot of books about how the Republicans are much more successful with their message, but I don't think they're much more successful with the young, per se. I think the young are just adopting to this whole world of nanotechnology and no job access and multiple jobs and gigs, and you know, that is really changing the world. College has changed because they don't know what to teach in college now because they don't know what the kids are going to face in terms of employment.
This is Jack Roberts. I basically agree with Tony, and I think the reality is that young people get involved when they think it affects them, and that a lot of the disillusionment I think that a lot of kids have today is that they don't know that anything that's being done at the government level really matters. Most of them do not yet rely on government programs. They don't realize how much they rely on it, and they don't think they're getting anything from it. They don't expect to get anything from it. Part of what we really need to do is to help draw the connection between the things that we're doing as a government and the things that affect people in their lives. That's hard to do when the battles that are taking place often seem to be over obscure things and special interests on one side or another that don't really affect average people. I do believe that people get involved when there are things that they think matter. I remember I was a generation, the thing that really got people involved was the draft and the Vietnam War. And you know, given what I said earlier, I want to remind people that the first presidential candidate to advocate a volunteer army was Barry Goldwater, and it was actually adopted during the Nixon administration. But we got rid of the draft. Now we're finding other ways to fund these wars and sending people off to them. We're talking about how bad it is, but for the average young person who doesn't enlist, it doesn't affect them. And that's what we have to do, is find a way to draw that connection for them so they can help make the right decisions for all of our future.
Hi, this is Mary Layton. I'm a City Club member. So I want to follow up quite accidentally. I'd like you to give me a kid to build a dream on. Think back into your acquaintance among up-and-coming Republicans and Democrats. Local would be good. State or national would be good. Talk about what it looks like in the younger generation from a personal perspective when a young person embraces being a Republican or being a Democrat in a way that we might find hopeful.
Well, that's tough for two old guys like us, because we're not quite as connected. I would start by saying I do think there continue to be new people getting involved in politics who have a fresh perspective, and assuming they don't get into the system and get co-opted by the status quo, can still do things differently. And this is where, and I won't make a long pitch on this, but this is one of the places where Tony and I really disagree, because I think everything he said about Newt Bueller was wrong, and that Newt has taken a fresh perspective. He's actually worked with Democrats on a lot of issues. I think he can do that, because he's only been in the legislature two terms and hasn't been through the system of learning all the things that you can't do until after you have a chance to, in fact, do them. And I think that's a lot of what we're going to rely on, are some new blood and some fresh perspectives and people who will do things differently. There's no magic bullet for any of this stuff. And I think any of us can tell you, when you're in the legislature for a while, or you're in this, I was a county commissioner, and my colleague Jerry Russ there and I worked together. In fact, it was funny. At one time, Jerry joked that it's the first time he was part of a two-person majority on a five-person board, because we could usually find that third vote somewhere if we could agree on something. And you know, we came from very different political backgrounds, but what we learned is that the nuts and bolts of county government are not partisan issues. And it's really, how do you get things done? I think there are examples of that going on. We need to find ways to advertise that and to celebrate that. But otherwise, there's no magic bullet as to how we turn the system around. It takes people.
Well, I'm reminded of a contract lobbyist that I really liked up in Salem, who told me, he lives in Marion County, he goes, Tony, I went to a Marion County Democratic Party meeting for the first time in 20 years. Not only were the same people there, they were sitting in the same chairs asking the same questions. So I'm probably the wrong guy to talk to about this, but I will tell you that I'm not very good at meetings. I've lost most of my patience. And I went to the Lane County Democratic Organizational meeting because Floyd had told me that there was going to be a possible fight because of all the new Bernie folks that had come in, and you know, there was an attempt to, you know, send a delegation up and you know, do some real structural stuff in the Democratic Party. And that's all these young kids. I mean, to answer your question, that's the latest group of young kids I've seen. They were Bernie motivated. Having said that, I told you earlier, 20% of those people voted for Trump. So, I mean, self-identified. So I don't know what the correct answer is. I just know that there's pretty good energy. The Democratic Party place was packed. There was a lot of new names. I like their new chair. You know, so I don't really have a lot to say about how you bring people in. Jack's right. It really has to do with, is this affect me or not?
Ruth Miller, and I think this has been a great program. A lot of history that I remember all of this. But my question is about PERSE. And what are we going to do about PERSE to convince the public that we need to pay for the PERSE and not keep rejecting money for schools because of that? And it just seems they use that all the time to object to supporting the paying off the PERSE.
PERSE is complex. The reason why I so disagree with Jack on Newt Bueller is that Newt Bueller was nowhere around the PERS discussion. He was out there with Farioli and the other guys just saying obstruct, obstruct, obstruct. And so for him to come out and then say, oh, but you know, we got to fix PERS because education is failing, is absolute baloney. He had no conversations about tax replacement either. So you can't have one without the other. That's one issue. The other issue is, in 95 and 2003, we really did pick the low-hanging fruit. You know, we changed the mortality rate for PERS. You know, the thing that didn't go was the 8% guarantee. And the courts since then have made, you know, other strong arguments that a deal's a deal and PERS has to be left alone. The structural problem that led to this unfunded actuarial liability was solved in the 2003 session, only to the extent that we changed the composition of the board. The board, the reason they cut themselves such a fat hog was that it was four PERS members and four non-PERS members before that those board changes. And depending on who the governor was, that non-PERS member, one of those four, was going to be pro-PERS. So they got what they wanted, and what they got was 100, those that that retired from 1998 to 2001 got on average 105% of their wages. PERS was never intended for that, thus the unfunded liability. But that unfunded liability, like I said, $4 billion of it was just a recent court decision, and the other is the failure of the stock market. And so, you know, we're gonna have to pony up extra money. There's just no question about it. They're changing some of the, you know, requirements for the rates of return and stuff, but it's going to be a mell of a hess, and all you got to do is just wait for all us Tier 1 people to die. That's the bottom line, and I'm 68.
This is Jack Roberts. Unfortunately, Tony's right. We do have to die off first. I'm like Tony. I'm also a Tier 1, but I only had 15 years of service, so my PERS is not going to make anybody rich. But the system was flawed, and it's now been changed. But the problem is, when you have a long-term system, the bills come due. And there is no constitutional or, frankly, any moral basis for going back and saying, you know, that deal we made with you, it turned out not to be good for us, and we want to break it. So there isn't going to be a magic bullet of how to solve this, and how do we convince the public that we can get out of that? How can we convince them that the system for people going forward, people who were hired late 1990s and since then, are not getting that same deal and it's not available to them, but we have to pay for the retirement for the others, is going to be difficult, it's going to be painful. But until we get people who are willing to be honest about that, and again, point to the history of what's happened, we've tried to change it and the courts have said no, we're going to continue to struggle.
John DeLow, and I'd like your opinion on party polarization. I was wondering how much you think that Fox News and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh have affected the situation we have today.
This is Jack Roberts again. I think the rise of talk radio and the fact that it's tied into, interestingly enough, the market is really there for conservative listeners. And before Rush Limbaugh came along, the radio and TV people were convinced that was not the case. They were convinced that most people thought the way they did, and they were all liberals. So they thought that was the majority out there. They did light a torch, and it's still burning. I think it's losing a lot of its effect. And that the polarization that they represent, I don't know that they've created it so much as they've responded to the polarization that was already there. They don't get listeners who then get converted to their point of view. They get people out there who already believe a lot of those things, and they tell them what they want to hear, give them either fake news or false conclusions drawn from incomplete facts. And however you look at it, I think that it's created a problem that we're going to have to address as a society with better information and helping to clarify the facts, which there's still plenty that we can disagree on, but let's at least try to get a unified set of facts and reality and not have the crazy stuff that's going on, or for that matter, people who hide behind their prejudices and don't have them be challenged. But as long as we have this fragmented media market where people can go and select the message they want to hear, unfortunately, a lot of them are going to continue to hear that and to build on it and associate with people who only share their views.
Tony Corcoran here. One of the nice things about not having to read unemployment insurance cases anymore is I get to read real books. And Moral Tribes by Joshua Green and the one by Jonathan Haidt, Why Reasonable People Disagree, really opened my eyes to a lot of the research that's being done in psychology, ethics, and sort of all these intermeshed fields now about self-confirmation, about, you know, it's us, it's me versus you and everybody else, then it's us versus them, and we tend to believe what we all hold as a tribe. And so I don't know how you break that down. There's no fixing stupid. So, you know, the people that listen to Alex Jones or whoever those clowns are, you know, and come up with the stuff they come up with, I don't know what to say to them, you know. Just nod your head, you know.
Okay, we have time for two quick questions. Thanks.
Mike Rowe, City Club member. My experience on a Board of Education brought me to an understanding that part of the PERS problem was magnified because some entities were not keeping up on their payments. They were making decisions to delay paying their share into PERS that they owed. Is that still going on? And how is that enforced at the state level?
That's easy to answer. I don't have a clue. I know that what's so complicated is that there are different pools within PERS, you know, the school districts and, you know, the state workers and the county workers and city workers. So those risk pools are, I thought, were statewide. And the only behavior that I've seen that's kind of scary, and I can't really blame the municipalities that are doing it, but I think it's really crazy to bond your PERS debt because you never get that back. You're just paying more money after that. So I don't know what the individual solution is for the individual school district or whatever, but I don't think borrowing to pay that off makes much sense. I mean, you got to own up to taxes. You got to own up to fair taxes. I mean, there's a reason that Uncle Phil gave whatever, $300,000, $500,000 to the Anti-Measure 97 campaign. There's a reason he put $500,000 into Newt Bueller's campaign before the filing deadline was even completed. And it was because Kate Brown supported 97. So, I mean, it all comes down to taxes. Taxes, you know, determines behavior. That's why everybody from Idaho buys their cars in Oregon.
This is Jack Roberts. I agree that this is not a major. I don't think it's a major contributor. I think the fact that people not paying, I think it has added to the problem. I, to some extent, disagree with Tony a little bit on ruling out using debt at some point to try to balance out the high retirement payments now under the old PERS system, when we have reason to believe that's going to even out in the future. And so using that, but you have to do it prudently and wisely, and you have to make sure that you're borrowing money not because you don't have it, but because you have a better plan for how to repay it.
So we have 2 minutes of airtime left.
Okay. What tax measure to fund the schools has any chance whatsoever?
Good question.
This is Jack Roberts. Now it's my turn to say I don't have a clue. I think we're going to have to try a lot of different things, but what ultimately will pass and what will hit the voters' fancy at the right time, at the right place, I have no idea.
Well, as Senator Morissette knows, people like Lee Beyer and Bill Dwyer, myself, I was on revenue every session, pushed for a gross receipts tax. The failure of Measure 97, I think, lays at the feet of the public sector unions. I think 97 was too big. And that scared the hell out of me. And the reason it scared me is that I think it set back the chances of getting progressive tax reform in Oregon by 10 years. Because they showed that they were successful with money and with demonstrating that a gross receipts tax can be looked at as a sales tax. And anytime you call anything a sales tax in Oregon, you're screwed. So, you know, I think
on
just
that
pointing
note, we
out.
We need to wrap it up.
Okay.
But, out of time.
All right.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry. We really are out of time. Thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday at 6:30. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. Next week's program, Friday, September 29th, is Hate Crimes in Eugene, Impact and Response. More details and information can be found on cityclubofeugene.org. Now, a big thank you and a round of applause for Tony Corcoran and Jack Roberts. Thank you. That concludes our program today.